White Wing, I want you to know we do all in our power to help you, and we wanted you to see your medium halfway through your sitting. Do you realize it did not affect the medium? We want you to know we have many experiments we want to make with you, and want to show you so much, but be patient, do not lose heart. All of us here on the other side send you our love and greetings. Until we meet again, farewell. The curtain was raised slowly. Mr. Flint was still in trance. Dr. West again examined the straps and adhesive tape, then removed the tape. Mr. Flint said he had not been aware that the curtain was raised during the sitting. On behalf of the four guests present, Dr. West expressed appreciation at having been allowed to witness such an interesting demonstration and particularly to thank Mr. Flint for his arduous part in making the experiment possible. Although I had been in trance throughout the test sitting, which had saved me from experiencing the actual discomfort of the straps binding me to my chair or the plasters sealing my mouth so tightly I could hardly breathe, when I came back to myself after the seance I was absolutely exhausted. This exhaustion persisted even after a night's rest and so, knowing my sitters were unlikely to get results while I was in this depleted state, I cancelled all my appointments for some days to give myself a chance to recover my normal vitality. To say the least, I was dismayed to hear from Drayton Thomas that one of the psychical researchers present at the test had decided that I could speak from my stomach. A few days later I received a letter from Dr. West to say he was not satisfied Iris's negation ed with the test sitting because at the end of it he had observed that one of the plasters sealing my lips was no longer in line with the indelible pencil marking. He accepted blame for not taking sufficient care in applying the plaster, but said that since it had moved the test was spoiled and without value. He asked me to submit to a further test at the premises of the Society for Psychical Research under conditions of his own design and offered to pay a fee for my services if I did so. I am afraid I was disappointed enough and hurt enough to refuse to consider this invitation. My temperament is mercurial and an unexpected treat can lift me from the depths of depression to the peaks of happiness. So when I found a letter from Mae West on my breakfast table asking for a sitting, all my misery and resentment, over what I felt, probably quite wrongly, to be the unfairness of the psychical researchers, vanished and I was sitting on cloud nine. At that time Mae West was appearing in her own Broadway success Diamond Lil at the Prince of Wales Theatre in London and it was arranged that I would give her a sitting in her suite at the Savoy Hotel after her evening performance. A man introducing himself as Mae West's manager, who I later learned was named Mr. Timoney, met me when I arrived at the Savoy Hotel and conducted me to Mae's suite, which was as grand and luxurious as one might expect a star to have. I was hardly surprised to see several well-tailored men sitting around among the many Idiris's negation oral tributes and gift-wrapped packages which littered the drawing room of the suite. Mr. Timoney gave a casual wave in their general direction and muttered something about show business and I never did get any of them sorted out into individuality. When Miss West herself entered, the standardized luxury of the hotel apartment at once took on life, personality and glamour. She was in her 50s at this time but I found it hard to believe she was not a girl. She was dazzlingly attractive and her complexion was truly lovely. I was surprised to find how tiny she was because I had always imagined she was tall and statuesque. She came over to sit beside me and we talked about her films, all of which I had seen and enjoyed. Shortly Mr. Timoney shepherded the anonymous show business gentleman out of the apartment and I was alone with her. We continued talking and soon we were discussing psychic matters. I learned that Mae West was very far from the blatant sex symbol she represented on stage and screen. She neither smoked nor drank and her moral standards were more stringent than most. Her conversation was both witty and highly intelligent and she had spent years reading widely in the fields of psychic research and comparative religion. She eventually found her own truth in spiritualism and then through meditation and self-discipline developed psychic power of her own. She was and still is a most remarkable woman and I count it a privilege to be one of her friends. During our seance various entities spoke to Mae before her mother came, referring to herself as Matilda. May and her mother talked affectionately together for some time, then May, no doubt as a test, asked her mother to mention the special pet name May had given to her in her lifetime. The mother answered, Diamond Tilly. Later, May told me she had called her mother by this somewhat extraordinary name because after the success of each of her Broadway shows, May had presented her mother with a brooch, a ring or earrings made of diamonds. May's mother also told her on request that her name before marriage to May's father had been Dolger. After this, sitting at the Savoy Hotel, May came to sit with me in my house at Hendon on several occasions. No one could possibly mistake May for anything but a great star, and her arrival created. While the Reverend Charles Drayton Thomas served on the committee of the Temple of Light and was a member of my own home circle, he wore quite a different hat as a member of the Council of the Society for Psychical Research. This society was founded in 1882 by a group of scholars and scientists whose purpose was to make a systematic investigation of certain phenomena which appear inexplicable on any generally recognized hypothesis, and as a body the SPR is generally considered to be the most skeptical in the world. However, once Drayton Thomas had been convinced by various stringent tests of his own that the phenomena produced by my mediumship were not only genuine, but of a high order, he had the courage of his conviction and appeared on the platform at many of my demonstrations to testify publicly to the reality of the voices. It came to Dre's ears that some of his colleagues in the SPR who had attended one of my demonstrations were suggesting the voices were produced by my lips and that I might be obtaining the messages clairaudiently. Dre was determined to devise a test which, if successful, would dispose of this suggestion once and for all. Naturally, I agreed to whatever test conditions he laid down, as I have always agreed to cooperate when I felt a researcher was honest, sincere and open-minded. As to the outcome of Drayton Thomas' experimental test, I cannot do better than to quote from the account of it which he had published in the Psychic News on February 14, 1948. On February 5, I placed over his tightly closed lips a strip of elastoplast. It was 5.5 inches long and 2.5 inches wide and very strongly adhesive. This I pressed firmly over and into the crevices of the closed lips. A scarf was then tied tightly over this and the medium's hands tied firmly to the arms of his chair. Another cord was so tied that he would be unable to bend down his head. Thus, supposing he endeavored during trance to loosen the bandage, it would be quite impossible for him to reach it. Anyone can discover by tightly closing the lips and trying to speak how muffled and unintelligible are the sounds then produced. My experiment was designed to show that under the above conditions clearly enunciated speech and plenty of it could be produced by the direct voice. The experiment was entirely successful. Voices were soon speaking with their usual clarity, and Mickey emphasized his ability several times by shouting loudly. Some 12 persons were present and we all heard more than enough to convince the most obdurate skeptic that the sealing of Mr. Flint's mouth in no way prevented unseen speakers from saying anything they wished. At the close of the sitting I examined the cords and the plaster, finding all intact and undisturbed. The plaster was so strongly adhering I had considerable difficulty in removing it without causing pain. Not long after this account appeared in print, I gave a demonstration at Kingsway Hall, and afterwards Drayton Thomas described this test and its successful outcome to the 2,000 people in the audience. Dre was very anxious to repeat his test in the presence of the research officer of the SPR, who at that time was Dr. D.J. West. I agreed to cooperate, and so on May 7, 1948, Dre brought Drive West and 3 other guests to my seance room at Sydney Grove. After Dr. West and Mr. Dennis Parsons, an SPR colleague of his, had examined the cabinet to make certain no microphone or other apparatus was concealed in it, I took my place inside, sitting on an ordinary upright chair. Dr. West and Mr. Parsons then strapped my extended arms to the side posts of my chair, then bound each arm to the chair by winding a long thread of embroidery silk round and round. They then put adhesive plaster across my lips, 2 strips overlapping horizontally, held in place by crisscross strips vertically, and marked the position of the plasters by tracing around them with indelible pencil. The cabinet was then closed and the light in the seance room was left on. This is from a shorthand transcript that was taken of what followed. The Reverend Drayton Thomas gave the invocation. There was a little music and within a few minutes a voice said, "Good evening." This voice was very loud and clear and Drayton Thomas replied, "Very glad to hear your voice." Another voice, "Hello, can you hear?" A sitter, "Yes, we can hear you quite well." Mickey, "Hello, Dre." Drayton Thomas, "Hello, Mickey. Delighted to hear you, especially under these difficult conditions." A sitter, "Is Leslie all right? Is he comfortable, Mickey?" No reply. Voice, "Hello, can you hear me?" A sitter, "Yes, we can hear you, friend. Quite well." Mr. Flint's breathing becomes very heavy. Voice, "Yes, I think so. Dot dot dot. Wonder if they would like to have." Mickey, "Hello, how are you?" Dre, "How are you?" Drayton Thomas, "Cheered by hearing you, Mickey. Try and see how loud you can shout in these difficult conditions." Voice, "All in good time." There were two voices in discussion, talking quite quietly. Not every word was clear enough to be heard, but one voice said, "Yes, we must do that. Yes, I know, we will do that. He is all right now." A sitter, "We cannot hear so well, can you speak a little louder?" Voice, "There is a certain tenseness there. We have to make allowances. Would you like to have a look at the medium?" Drayton Thomas, "You know we have full light here?" Voice, "Just to satisfy yourselves." Dr. West, "Do you mean we may look at the medium now? We are ready to raise the curtain if you are ready for us. We are willing to look now if you say so." Voice, "Go ahead." Dr. West then raised the curtain. Mr. Flint was in his chair in a trance, with straps and adhesive tape intact. Dr. West made a close inspection and then closed the curtain. This was at 8:15 p.m. Voice, "Quite all right?" Dr. West, "Thank you, friend." Drayton Thomas, "You seem to have him in very deep trance." Voice, "Very necessary for such an experiment." Drayton Thomas, "Willis. Music, please." Voice, "Don't be impatient, Mr. Drayton Thomas." Drayton Thomas, "I suppose I am impatient just now, but for this I have really a lot of patience and staying power." Voice, "How long have you been in this now?" Drayton Thomas, 30 years. Voice, "How is your wife?" Drayton Thomas, "Thank you, she is very well, better than she has been for a very long time." Voice, "I am very glad. I want you to realize we are working here under great difficulties." Drayton Thomas, "That is obvious, but we are getting so many voices." Mickey, "What about me? I'm here, you know." Drayton Thomas, "Yes, Mickey, we are very glad to hear you so clearly." Voice, "Very loud and clear. God bless you all. This is White Wing. I am very pleased to be here. I want you to realize we are working under difficulties, but we are very happy to be here with you." A sitter, "Thank you very much, we are very glad to hear you. White Wing, you know, Mr. Willis, your cabinet is not dark, no. The light comes in through the top, not through the vent, through the curtain. It makes it more difficult. Never mind, we are very anxious to help you and cooperate with you all." Dr. West, "We are very pleased to hear that. White Wing, I want you to know we do all in our power to help you, and we wanted you to see your medium halfway through your sitting. Do you realize it did not affect the medium? We want you to know we have many experiments we want to make with you, and want to show you so much, but be patient, do not lose heart. All of us here on the other side send you our love and greetings. Until we meet again, farewell." The curtain was raised slowly. Mr. Flint was still in trance. Dr. West again examined the straps and adhesive tape, then removed the tape. Mr. Flint said he had not been aware that the curtain was raised during the sitting. On behalf of the four guests present, Dr. West expressed appreciation at having been allowed to witness such an interesting demonstration and particularly to thank Mr. Flint for his arduous part in making the experiment possible. Although I had been in trance throughout the test sitting, which had saved me from experiencing the actual discomfort of the straps binding me to my chair or the plasters sealing my mouth so tightly I could hardly breathe. When I came back to myself after the séance, I was absolutely exhausted. This exhaustion persisted even after a night's rest, and so, knowing my sitters were unlikely to get results while I was in this depleted state, I cancelled all my appointments for some days to give myself a chance to recover my normal vitality. To say the least, I was dismayed to hear from Drayton Thomas that one of the psychical researchers present at the test had decided that I could speak from my stomach. A few days later, I received a letter from Dr. West to say he was not satisfied Iris's negation ed with the test sitting, because at the end of it he had observed that one of the plasters sealing my lips was no longer in line with the indelible pencil marking. He accepted blame for not taking sufficient care in applying the plaster, but said that since it had moved, the test was spoiled and without value. He asked me to submit to a further test at the premises of the Society for Psychical Research under conditions of his own design, and offered to pay a fee for my services if I did so. I am afraid I was disappointed enough and hurt enough to refuse to consider this invitation. My temperament is mercurial, and an unexpected treat can lift me from the depths of depression to the peaks of happiness. So when I found a letter from Mae West on my breakfast table asking for a sitting, all my misery and resentment over what I felt, probably quite wrongly, to be the unfairness of the psychical researchers, vanished, and I was sitting on cloud nine. At that time, Mae West was appearing in her own Broadway success Diamond Lil at the Prince of Wales Theatre in London, and it was arranged that I would give her a sitting in her suite at the Savoy Hotel after her evening performance. A man introducing himself as Mae West's manager, who I later learned was named Mr. Timoney, met me when I arrived at the Savoy Hotel and conducted me to Mae's suite, which was as grand and luxurious as one might expect a star to have. I was hardly surprised to see several well-tailored men sitting around among the many Iris's negation oral tributes and gift-wrapped packages which littered the drawing room of the suite. Mr. Timoney gave a casual wave in their general direction and muttered something about show business, and I never did get any of them sorted out into individuality. When Miss West herself entered, the standardized luxury of the hotel apartment at once took on life, personality and glamour. She was in her 50s at this time, but I found it hard to believe she was not a girl. She was dazzlingly attractive, and her complexion was truly lovely. I was surprised to find how tiny she was, because I had always imagined she was tall and statuesque. She came over to sit beside me, and we talked about her films, all of which I had seen and enjoyed. Shortly, Mr. Timoney shepherded the anonymous show business gentleman out of the apartment, and I was alone with her. We continued talking, and soon we were discussing psychic matters. I learned that Mae West was very far from the blatant sex symbol she represented on stage and screen. She neither smoked nor drank, and her moral standards were more stringent than most. Her conversation was both witty and highly intelligent, and she had spent years reading widely in the fields of psychic research and comparative religion. She eventually found her own truth in spiritualism, and then through meditation and self-discipline developed psychic power of her own. She was and still is a most remarkable woman, and I count it a privilege to be one of her friends. During our séance, various entities spoke to Mae before her mother came, referring to herself as Matilda. Mae and her mother talked affectionately together for some time, then Mae, no doubt as a test, asked her mother to mention the special pet name Mae had given to her in her lifetime. The mother answered, "Diamond Tilly." Later, Mae told me she had called her mother by this somewhat extraordinary name because after the success of each of her Broadway shows, Mae had presented her mother with a brooch, a ring or earrings made of diamonds. Mae's mother also told her on request that her name before marriage to Mae's father had been Dolger. After this, sitting at the Savoy Hotel, Mae came to sit with me in my house at Hendon on several occasions. No one could possibly mistake Mae for anything but a great star, and her arrival created a local sensation each time she paid me a visit. A spirit who quoted word for word a verse from her own memorial card was a high point of another of my demonstrations in the Kingsway Hall. The spirit voice of a woman said her name was Beatrice Maestrud and she wanted to speak to Laura. A woman in the crowded hall called out saying she was Laura. It's me dot 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 it's Beatty. Said the spirit voice, oh, I'm so glad I can speak to you. Speak up and tell me something, Beat, called Laura. I'm doing my best, answered the spirit. I died on the 6th of February 1945 and I was 57, or was I 58? Where did you come from? Asked Laura and Beatrice answered at once, New Zealand. Then Laura was herself questioned by the spirit voice. Are you going back to New Zealand? Did you go down to Bedford? Remember the time we were together last, said Beatrice. I remember the verse you wrote on my memorial card. We learned later on that Beatrice and Laura were cousins as well as dear friends and Bedford was where Beatrice's body was buried. Can you tell me the words on your card, Beat? Asked Laura. I'll try, responded the spirit voice. Then very slowly she recited 9 lines of a sentimental verse, word for word. That's right, Beat, said Laura. I know you are going back to New Zealand in 2 weeks, continued the irrepressible Beatrice, adding, do you remember Hetty Court? Laura said she did. Then Beatrice told her their friend Hetty was now in the spirit world and she had to change a few of her ideas. You know she was a Christian scientist, Beatrice suddenly announced, Spurgeon is here. Whereupon Laura stood up and informed the audience that she and her cousin Beatrice were direct descendants of the famous preacher, Charles Haddon Spurgeon. When my wife Edith was again able to lead a normal though sadly restricted life and the household was running smoothly under Bill's management, my committee sent me further and further Aidiresis Negation Eld to demonstrate in as many provincial towns and cities as possible. I would leave London on the day of the demonstration accompanied by either Father Sharp or Drayton Thomas or whoever was to act as chairman at my meeting and when we reached our destination we would remain in each other's company until the demonstration. The chairman could then honestly assure the audience that I'd had no opportunity to glean information by looking around local cemeteries, studying directories, listening to local gossip or by any other means. After the meeting I would travel back to London. These out-of-town meetings were especially tiring because of the double journey and the unfamiliar conditions, but I never begrudged the effort they cost me, because many thousands who might otherwise never have had the opportunity experienced the most comforting of all contacts with their dead through the direct voice. I remember an occasion at the Salem Central Hall in Leeds when one of the most evidential communications of the meeting made the audience of 1,200 people rock with laughter. Mickey spoke to a woman sitting in the front of the hall and asked her if she let rooms to theatricals. When the lady admitted she did, Mickey told her there was a bloke who wanted to speak to her who had played the part of the cat in Dick Whittington 7 or 8 years before, adding, he was so small he seemed like a dwarf. The woman started to say she thought she knew who it was when she was interrupted by the spirit himself speaking excitedly. This is a rum do, isn't it? He said, I never thought I'd ever speak to you like this. Do you remember when I was in Dick Whittington at the Theatre Royal? Of course I do, replied the lady. Do you still like fish and chips? This prompted a reminder from Mickey that such things were not needed in the spirit world. Dick Whittington's cat chipped in again to say, I was the best cat in the business, there wasn't anyone to touch me. His friend in the audience replied, I always thought you were. Dick's cat then reminded the lady that she had a photograph which showed him in his cat's costume, holding the head in his hands. Then he asked if she still had the bed with the brass knobs and the lady, who was later identified as Ms. Hennessy of Brunswick Terrace, Leeds, said she had disposed of it. Mickey then spoke again telling her that the cat was now talking about Bella and saying she was letting it rip now. When Ms. Hennessy informed the audience that Bella was the cat's wife, the hall rocked with laughter. A psychical researcher, whose name I have long since forgotten, once published a theory that the voices my sitters hear are not real voices. He suggested that through a combination of hypnotic power on my part and the subconscious longing of my sitters, auditory hallucinations are induced which say whatever the sitters are longing to hear. This glib little theory was smartly knocked on the head when in September 1948, during a demonstration at Denison House in London, an American wire recorder was used in order to produce gramophone records of the spirit voices. This experiment was highly successful. Every message was recorded as clearly as when it was first spoken by the discarnate communicator. I hoped for a long time that the creator of the auditory hallucination theory would come forward to explain how it was possible to record delusionary voices, but as far as I know, he never did. In his capacity as a member of the Council of the Society for Psychical Research, Drayton Thomas had made contact with another psychical researcher, an electronics expert who was able to provide various devices which could be used to prove or to disprove the reality of my voices. So a series of tests were held, some at the home of the electronics expert and others on the SPR premises. They were conducted under the direction of Reverend Drayton Thomas and held in the presence of such notable researchers as Brigadier Firebrace CBE, Father Arthur Sharp, Mr. F. Sibley and others. The conditions under which I sat for these tests were: A. My lips were sealed with plaster. B. A throat microphone was attached to my throat and wired to amplifiers so that the slightest sound made through my own larynx would be magnified enormously. C. The researchers were able to watch my every movement in the dark by means of an infrared telescope. And finally, D. My hands were held by a sitter on either side of me. Spirit voices spoke at many of the tests under these conditions, and on more than one occasion a researcher viewing through the infrared telescope was able to see the ectoplasmic voice box or larynx through which the discarnate people speak. It formed on my left side some 2 feet distant from me, which is the same point in space that the spirit voices are normally located during my seances. My thanks are due to Brigadier Firebrace for his courtesy in allowing me to quote an extract from one of his letters to me, which I think speaks for itself. I well remember the test sittings I had with you and Drayton Thomas. At these sittings during the seance, we had an infrared telescope focused on you and you had a throat microphone around your throat. There was an electronic expert present who watched the instruments which were attached to the throat microphone. I can well remember that under these conditions we got the direct voice without any indication on the instruments that it was registered by the throat microphone. But the voices were fainter than on previous sittings I'd had with you. An interesting point was on the final occasion when, with a voice speaking faintly, the infrared telescope suddenly fused. The voice immediately doubled in volume. This indicated to me that infrared rays weaken mediumship in some way. I must add, you could not possibly have known that the infrared telescope was out of action. Altogether an impressive exhibition of mediumistic power. I think I can safely say I am the most tested medium this country has ever produced, and, I will add, the medium most willing to be tested whenever I have felt truth would be served by submitting to conditions imposed on me by those I believe to be genuine researchers. I have been boxed up, tied up, sealed up, gagged, bound and held, and still the voices have come to speak their message of life eternal. I have given impromptu sittings in hotel rooms and in the homes of strangers. I have demonstrated in foreign countries, in halls, theatres and churches, often under conditions where it has been impossible to obtain complete darkness or when the atmosphere has been extremely skeptical or even downright hostile, and still the voices have come. When first I began to allow myself to be tested, I was naive enough to believe that if the tests were successful, the scientists and researchers who had carried them out would proclaim to the world the truth of life after death. All too soon I learned the hard way that many of those who call themselves researchers have immutable values of their own, which preclude belief in a meaning or purpose in man's existence or in the possibility of a life after death. Their concern was rather to disprove the reality of my voices, and they would postulate any alternative, however far-fetched or absurd, sooner than admit the implication of their own successful experiment. I was therefore doubly blessed when I was tested by men of the caliber of Reverend Drayton Thomas, Father Sharp and Brigadier Firebrace, who, when their tests were successful, came forward to state their conviction publicly. A favorite explanation of my voice phenomena is that I am some kind of super ventriloquist and mimic. I fear those who seriously entertain this absurd theory display complete ignorance of the art of ventriloquism. Any ventriloquist will tell you it is impossible for him to work in complete darkness.